This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We've all been there. You're trying to explain a problem to a friend, and it feels like you might very well be speaking in tongues. You lay out everything, clear as day, and somehow still manage to fall flat. Now, imagine that kind of scenario, except you're a scientist who's getting close to a groundbreaking discovery or a life-saving cure. How should scientists become better communicators for the general public? And what about the rest of us? How can we all get better at relating? The answer? Theater games and improv. At least, that's what worked for Alan Alda. He details his methods and his experiences in his new book called If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? My Adventures in the Art and Science of Relating and Communicating. And he joins us now from NPR in New York. Alan Alda, welcome to 1A.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me on with you.
How are you? How is life teaching people to relate these days?
You know, it's very exciting. I just came from a workshop that I'm getting back to in a few minutes, a workshop for women in business, which sounds odd compared to what you just described the work as. But mm-hmm. I also have a company that trains people in better communication in corporations. And although it's a profit-making company, all the money goes to the Center for Communicating Science that I helped start at Stony Brook University. So we're working in a lot of different directions to improve communication, all beneficial to humankind, I think.
Well, if there's anything that it seems like we need to get better at least in this country today, it's learning how to just talk to one another, and we will spend the rest of this hour discussing what you've learned. We certainly want your questions and thoughts as well. Any questions you have about just how to be a more effective communicator, how to speak so that you're heard and understood, how to connect, and also if you have stories to share of what you've done that worked or maybe that didn't, we would love to hear from you for the rest of the hour. So email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Alan Alda, I wonder if you get the sense that now is a time more than ever where we need to learn to talk to one another all over again. I can't tell you how many of my friends, when they found out that I got this job, were like, ooh, sorry, you picked a bad time to start a network talk show because this is when everybody's yelling at everybody. Does it seem like that to you?
Yeah, I think it probably seems like that to everybody. I mean, I know people who shush their friends about talking at the dinner table because they know somebody at the other end of the table is violently opposed to their point of view. And we're not helping one another by shushing ourselves. We have to learn to communicate better because there's something underneath that we're all probably commonly in favor of. And if we can find that, then we can get something done. But if the other person is a demon just because they disagree, then that's not so helpful.
I read the book. It is fascinating and delightful. I can kind of hear your voice through the entire book. And you talk about a number of encounters that you've had with communication where you had to learn to raise your game and where you encountered other people who needed to communicate better. One of the stories you tell early in the book is about some oral surgery that you had that affected your smile from there on out. And the oral surgeon didn't do a very good job of kind of warning you of what was coming. Could you relate that story?
Not very good at all.
Yeah.
He had the scalpel poised just inches from my mouth as he was about to operate on my gum. And he said, now there'll be some tethering. And I didn't know what he was talking about. I said, tethering? He said, yes, tethering, tethering. He didn't use another word for it. He didn't go into an explanation. And he had some procedure that he had invented that he really was interested in using on me. But I didn't know what the facts were about it. And I didn't have a chance to question him because he was pretty brusque about the whole thing. And I let him go ahead and do it because I was impressed by his surgical gown and the manner he had, you know, which was, I know what I'm doing. Don't bother me. Huh. And as it turned out, he sort of gave me a smilectomy. He cut that little piece of tissue between the top of your gum and your upper lip. I believe the term is frenum for it. And as a result, I was making a movie a couple of weeks later, and I smiled in a scene, and the cameraman said to me, "I thought you were going to smile. What was that sneer about?" And I said, "I was smiling." He said, no, you were sneering. Go look in the mirror." And I had this funny, droopy smile. And when I told the dentist about it, hoping he could explain more clearly to other patients what he was about to do when he did that operation on them, he wasn't interested. He sent me a letter outlining why I shouldn't sue him, which is like pretty much the wrong way to go about it, because studies have shown that when doctors apologize after the patient's unhappy, lawsuits go down considerably, like almost in half. So thinking about the other person, which is really what the book is about, as you try to communicate with someone, thinking about what they're thinking, what they're feeling, and add that to this brilliant message you've created, then the communication will work. At least that's what we found at training about 8,000 scientists and doctors, is this idea that if you have the best message in the world, how good is it if it doesn't land on the other person, if it doesn't really get into them and be internalized by them, and if they don't resonate to it?
Yeah, I do want to
talk. Totally misunderstand it.
I do want to talk to you more about the training that you do with scientists. But with regard to the example you had and kind of what the problem is, I wonder what in your experience you see as the big one or two maybe overarching reasons why communication breaks down. I began to think as you related these stories in the book and as you just told it now, I feel like a lot of it is just fear. Either fear of looking stupid or fear of feeling vulnerable or fear of looking incompetent, like, "Oh, it's tethering. Just let me do it. I have a surgical gown. I must know what I'm talking about." Yeah. Just this fearfulness of being vulnerable with another person who might end up seeing you as you really are through what you have to say.
I think you're probably on the right track there. It's equivalent to stage fright. It's the fear of being judged, being out on stage. What are they thinking of me? Can they tell I'm too fat around the middle? What do my clothes fit? Is my hair okay? All of these worries that we have when we expose ourselves to the public are very similar to the fear we have just facing another person and trying to make ourselves clear. And we avoid the personal because that seems like it'll make us open and vulnerable to criticism. The kind of counterintuitive fact seems to be that fear goes away. For instance, the fear of stage fright goes away during an improvisation because you're connected to the other person and your mind is on them and it's not on yourself. And getting your mind off yourself and onto the other person just washes away fear because you're engaged in something other than worrying about how you're doing.
We're spending the hour speaking with Alan Alda, the author of the new book, If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? My Adventures in the Art and Science of Communicating. Also previously the host of the excellent PBS science program, Scientific American Frontiers. And of course, a visiting professor at the Stony Brook University Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science. Talk to us about some of the improv work you do with scientists. You mentioned that some of these exercises are effective in helping people who communicate very technical information make it a little more human. Give us an example of one of the improv exercises that anyone could do to improve their skills.
Well, you kind of have to do them in a class that's not directed toward comedy improv, because we're not trying to turn scientists or anybody else into comedians. We're doing exercises that are very basic. Basic exercises that help you connect with the other person. I'll give you an example. One of the early exercises you do in improv is a mirroring game where you and I are facing each other and you're my mirror and everything I do is mirrored by you. Every motion I make is mirrored by you exactly at the same moment that I do it, just as if you were a mirror, with no time lag. So this requires a tremendous amount of coordination between the two of us and great observation of one another. and I really have to take care of you. If you're not following me as my mirror, it's my obligation to make sure you follow me. And this is a perfect image for communication, because if I'm trying to communicate something to you and you don't follow me, it's not your problem, it's my problem. I have to make sure that you follow what I'm saying. And the way I do that is by observing you. And that's why the book, which I love the way you read the title.
Well, the image of you on the cover and the title, I'm like, that's the only way I can hear it in my head.
Yeah. It's a wonderful cartoon by a guy who does a lot of New Yorker covers. He's a brilliant artist. And the idea that it's in the title, that if we observe one another's body language, face, tone of voice, we have a chance to make intimate contact with them, to be personal with them. And when that happens, time and again, I've seen the tone of voice change and become less formal. The vocabulary changes, because we're not thinking about what we have to say alone. We're thinking about how it's landing on the other person, and we're observing how it's landing. And the really counterintuitive thing that I think we've found, And I know, I'm pretty sure that I'm correct about this, is it doesn't only work when you're facing someone, it even works when you're writing for someone who's not there in front of you. Now, how can you observe them? How can you be aware of what's going on in their bodies or in their minds? And I think the way that you do it is, if you're thinking about how it's going to land on the reader and you have a general idea of who the reader is going to be, you can actually predict or make a good estimate of what the reader is going through when you put down the first sentence, and you can pretty much guess what they're ready for in the next sentence. So the concentration, not only on the wonderful things you have to say, but on how they might be understood, is a doorway into smooth passage of what you want to say to the other person. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we all have this impulse to do this. Even when we write emails and messaging,
right?
There's a little part of our head, no matter how truncated the message is, in some little part of our head, we're wondering how it's landing on the other person.
Yeah, right.
Which is why we use smileys and emoji. We want to make sure it's not misunderstood. So there's always, even in modern communication on cell phones, there's this vestigial awareness of the other person. And the more we build that up, the more we build on that desire to be aware, the better we can be. And you don't need to do it through improvising exercises alone. You can practice it during the day,
right,
in your private life.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. We got a number of messages from our listeners about how their ability to communicate factors in. Quite a few of them dealt with some pretty serious stuff, including this message that was left in our inbox.
Hi, this is Elena. Communication is very important. I'm a hairdresser, and then my brother, he had Lou Gehrig's disease, and he devised a way to communicate. He was bedridden for 20 years, and he came up with a system so he could communicate with his nurses. So communication is so important.
Wow. Yeah, Elena, thank you for sharing that story. Alan Alda, could you talk a little bit about some of the kinds of challenges that the scientists that you work with at Stony Brook are dealing with? It's one thing just communicating, you know, with a patient saying, you know, well, we're going to take out your appendix, but some of the scientists that you describe in the book are solving some very big challenges and dealing with some very serious medical issues that really require precision in communication.
Yeah, and it's the main thing that scientists and doctors alike have to think about, even though they're working in slightly different media or platforms. The scientist is communicating sometimes to an audience of 500 people, and the doctor is often communicating to one patient, and it's a slightly different thing. But the thing that's true in both cases is the awareness of not getting trapped in what has been called the curse of knowledge. The curse of knowledge, it's a funny phrase. Why would knowledge be a curse?
Right.
We all know knowledge is an important and good thing. It's a curse when you know something so deeply and in such complexity that you forget what it's like not to understand it that deeply, to be a beginner at it. And we have to constantly remind ourselves that terms that to us are commonplace are not so commonplace for other people. And this is true, by the way, not just communicating with the public for scientists, but when scientists communicate with one another, they have to make sure that the other person understands their lingo. There was a meeting of neuroscientists and nanoscientists when they were getting together for the first time to start the Obama Brain Initiative. The neuroscientists and the nanoscientists argued for hours about the meaning of one word, which was a common English word, the word probe.
Probe?
But it meant something different. Probe, P-R-O-B-E. It meant something different to each group. And they were kind of upset that the other person was using the word in a way they thought was not correct.
Huh.
So it's unless you're in the exact same field, sometimes in the exact same laboratory, you use different terms for things, and you can't assume that the other people know what you're talking about.
We're up against a break in just about a few seconds, but I wonder, can you give me just a tip? If we're in that kind of a business where it's very jargony, what's an easy way to kind of step outside of yourself and see what someone else might need explained? Very briefly, before we hit a break.
It's so simple. It's the title of the book. Keep thinking about what the other person is thinking. Keep asking questions. Keep finding out where they are and read the look on their face when it gets clouded and back up and figure out that you're probably not speaking to them.
Well, we actually got a number of comments from our listeners who totally agree with where you're coming from. Linda emailed us, please tell Mr. Alda he's doing a service to those of us trying to convince our colleagues that we don't need to perpetuate what's known as academic writing, a stylized method of writing that's bound to guarantee future teachers and students won't be able to communicate. Well, we're up against a break. We do want to talk more about how to do this when we complete our conversation with Alan Alda, the author of If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? My Adventures in the Art and Science of Communicating. Keep communicating your questions and stories to us, 1A@WAMU.org, tweet us at 1A, or comment on our Facebook page. We'll keep going after we pause to catch our breath. Stay close. I wanna know, what do you mean? When you nod your head yes, but you wanna say no, what do you mean? Before we get back to our conversation, a quick reminder that tomorrow is the next installment of our 1A Movie Club. And this time around, we are reviewing Wonder Woman, starring Gal Gadot, Chris Pine, Robin Wright, Connie Nielsen, and Danny Houston. There's a lot to talk about, including the story within the DC Comics Justice League storyline, the movie's strong feminist themes, and more. Give us your review of Wonder Woman. On a scale of 1 to 5 stars, how many stars would you give it? And why? Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A, and press option 2. How many stars out of 5 would you give Wonder Woman, and why? Tell us your story, 855-236-1A1A. That's 855-236-1212, and press option 2. You can also record yourself and email the audio file to 1A@WAMU.org. We will review Wonder Woman, spoilers and all, and share some of your reviews tomorrow on 1A. Back now to our conversation with Alan Alda, the author of the new book, If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? My Adventures in the Art and Science of Communicating. Still time to get your questions answered about how to improve your communication and relatability skills. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Alan Alda, a lot of the comments we've gotten this hour have had to do, with, I think, partly with the political climate we're in and just people's inability to really listen as we talked about at the top. Mike in Germantown, Maryland emailed, "What do you say when you communicate a topic perfectly for your audience, but the audience isn't receptive to facts that differ from their ideology or beliefs?" He uses climate change as an example. And Lori tweeted us, "How do you handle communications with a person who has no desire to listen, who only wants to make you agree with them?"
Yeah, those are terrific problems and ones we encounter every day. And increasingly, I think, as things get more heated in the political discourse in the country, I think that some people are beginning to develop strategies that sound very good to me. And some of these things I actually talk about in the book. The idea that you need to respect the other person, even if they clearly disagree with you and are kind of hostile with you. They're entitled to their opinion. They're not therefore stupid because they don't agree with you, or even that they don't accept the facts. They might be way smarter than you and know exactly what the facts are, but if you're attacking not just their knowledge, but their sense of identity, that's a serious thing for them. If they're attached to their view of the facts in such a way that to acknowledge the facts means they have to, in a way, surrender their identity as part of the group they're with, that's very difficult for them. And understanding that can make it less annoying to talk with them. But to find the common ground you have between you. Did you grow up in a similar place? Did you grow up with a similar set of values and that kind of thing? That commonality can be the first step toward not necessarily agreeing, but at least being able to talk together. And by the way, your notion that you're trying to communicate, if you're really open to seeing it from a different perspective, from the other person's perspective, it's a good model for the other person because they may know more than you do about certain aspects of it. Local conditions, when you're talking about climate change, people know their own local conditions and are concerned about them. And maybe the climate change term is a forbidden term for them, but a knowledge of how to improve their own local conditions and protect their own children, they may be very willing to talk about that.
You know, there's something else in the book.
Some of the argument has already been settled for a lot of people in the terms that it's already been used in. I don't know. What do you think of that?
Well, there's something. I hear you on that. And I think what you seem to be kind of edging towards is another aspect that you talk about in the book, which as a result of your dramatic training certainly is essential, which is the aspect of story and narrative, having a story to tell. I mean, I think it's one thing to argue with someone about climate change. It's another thing to say, you know, I grew up in South Florida and I have seen how coral reefs have bleached over the course of my lifetime. And I know there are areas that used to be walkable that are now underwater. Like, it's harder to argue someone's personal story, and it's also harder to harden your heart when someone just tells you their story.
I think that's absolutely correct. And not only that, but beyond that, which I think you indicate, storytelling is a powerful way to communicate for all of us. We all respond to the sound of a story so much better than a measured argument or a series of facts or statistics. A lot of people feel that if they put the statistics first, you're going to be really impressed with what they have to say. In fact, statistics, while they are impressive very often, if they don't come after a story that involves me and makes me want to listen to more of what you have to say, the statistics just sort of roll off me like off a duck.
So give me some guidance on how to tell a good story. For people who don't think they're good storytellers, I mean, I know it's just a beginning, a middle, and an end, but what's one really good tip for someone who wants to be better?
Aristotle's famous for saying a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Right.
I don't think that's the whole story. I think, not to offend Aristotle.
Right.
But he really nailed it, I thought, when he talked about what made Oedipus Rex a good play. And I'm from the theater, so of course that appeals to me a lot. The idea is you have a hero or a heroine who has a goal that's extremely important. Having a goal is involving to some extent, if you tell the story about someone with a goal. But if they start out with the goal and they achieve the goal and that's it, that's not much of a story. And I think what he meant by that's the, what you have there is the beginning and the end. The middle that he referred to is really interesting if you think about the way he talked about dramatic action in a play. In a play, the hero has an objective, has a goal, but there's an obstacle thrown in the path. And the hero or the heroine has to fight through that obstacle to get to the goal. That effort to achieve against the odds is what makes us rapt when we hear a story. We can't keep away from the story when we see the struggle of the leading person trying to get through it to get to the goal.
So I want to make sure I'm clear on what you're getting at. I know we got a lot of questions to get to, but I want to make sure I get your point. You're saying that it's not just enough when you're telling your story or a story to say what your goal is, to say what's at stake, but also to be clear about what's in the way.
Yeah, what went wrong? Mm-hmm. It's not enough to say, this is what I wanted to do and this is what I did. That's not really a story to me. The story, the really intriguing part of the story is, if you're a scientist, the beaker broke and 6 months of my work fell on the floor. My graduate student quit. I lost my funding. If you're telling the story to your child about what your experience with drugs was, the way it went wrong, the miscommunication, therefore, between you and your parents and how that was a real problem you had to work through. I'm spitballing.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to make an analogy. Any story you tell, the wife telling the story to her husband about why she needs him to spend more time or to really relate to her better, if she can tell a story that includes the idea that what she was trying to achieve was had a barrier that she had to crash through.
Right.
Then we'd listen to that story with a little more interest, I think.
We've gotten a number of questions from listeners about autism. Brenda emailed us, autism hits 1 in 4 males, including my ex-husband and 16-year-old son. Both are incredibly intelligent, but do not read the look on another person's face or body language. What to do? Alan, you talk a fair amount in the book about communication methods that work with people who are on the autism spectrum. What seems to work?
Well, very interestingly, I interviewed a scientist, a psychologist, who discovered that he could teach improvisation classes to people on the autistic spectrum, and they were very well prepared for the vagaries of life, for an uncertain life. The training up until then had been, the typical training had been presenting to the people on the spectrum scenarios that they might encounter in life and giving them a response to make. You know, look the person in the eye, but don't look too long in the eye because you're liable to freak them out.
And that, right.
They were very formulaic, and the teenagers he was working with were so impatient with being told how to behave in specific situations. They started throwing things at him. He didn't have their attention. And then some actor friends told him about improvising exercises, and he started to give them situations, wildly divergent situations, to get them ready for anything. And they were doing scenes like ordering ice cream on Mars and that kind of thing, so that they had a grasp of the general idea, but they weren't given specific instructions for specific situations, because life doesn't give you that. Life gives you curveballs all the time. And starting with the first person he started to work with, when the psychologist was 10 years old and was curious about I think a 2 or 3 year old boy who barely looked at him. Mm-hmm. By the time he had finished working with him through his schooling career, that boy has now graduated from graduate school and is functioning perfectly well.
Wow. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Let's get through a few more quick questions. We are low on time, and there's so much that our listeners would love to ask you about. Lorraine in Orlando, Florida, emailed us, "I like Mr. Alda as an actor. I so admire him for the communications work he's doing. I heard him interviewed on Science Friday, and I'm so impressed with his commitment to scientific communication, and I love the flame challenge. You describe this in the book in terms of a way to get scientists to explain a very simple concept that's not easy to explain to kids, like what is a flame? Some of the winning videos are on YouTube, and they're just fantastic, but what do you find the winners of these kinds of challenges have in common?"
They have in common the idea that they have, that they're talking to 11-year-olds, and the best of them have actually spoken to 11-year-olds. I interviewed the winner of the video category a couple of days ago on stage at the World Science Festival, and I said, "Did you try this video out on a real 11-year-old?" She said, "I tried it out on my 11-year-old son, and he gave me a lot of critiques on it. He told me where it wasn't working." And that's an example of keeping the listener in mind. Now, the wonderful thing, I'm so proud of this. The thing about the contest is scientists have to make something difficult, like what's a flame or what is energy, interesting and engaging, and explain it in a way that can be understood to real 11-year-olds. And the 11-year-olds around the world are the judges of the contest, not us, not the Center for Communicating Science. But the wonderful thing that I'm so proud of is that the woman who won in this category had taken our training in Australia. We have a connection with the National University of Australia. And she's been trained in this method, and she won the contest, judged by real 11-year-olds, not by us. So I'm just so proud of that.
Gear wrote us in Bridgehampton, New York, "Don't leave us hanging. Did Alan get his smile fixed?"
A lot of people ask me that. You know, I can't remember. The dentist said to me, "Hey, well, there's a second step you have to go through." And I told you there was another step, but, you know, he was again kind of hostile with me. Uh-huh. And I can't remember if I went back for the other step. My guess is I was a little nervous to let him go back in there. But now when I smile, I consciously use my cheek muscles to make it a better smile, so people don't notice.
Before we run out of time, one area of communication that I think a lot of people joke about is communication between spouses. And I believe you have been married to your wife, Arlene. Has it been 60 years?
60.
Well, first of all, congratulations. And secondly,
well, thank you.
What have you found? I'm sure the two of you have a lot of fun together and have kind of found a rhythm with each other at this point. But what have you found works in terms of your communication with your wife?
Well, we do a lot of laughing. We laugh like 10, 20 times a day, but heartily, you know. And it's not jokes. It's just fun, laughing together. But I noticed, you know, something funny happened to me. I hope this doesn't sound insincere, but because it's really true.
No, go ahead. We're almost out of time, but go ahead.
In the 2 years I've been writing this book, I've changed my ability to pay attention to the other person, especially to my wife, Arlene. And I find, I don't know what her report would be on this, but I keep her in mind a lot more. So I'm a happy customer of my own writing.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jillian actually just tweeted us for advice about communicating in the first years of marriage, because Jillian is getting married on Saturday. Congratulations, Jillian, and best of luck to you. We are very low on time, but Alan, before we run, can you give us an idea for people who want to learn more from the work that you're doing? Can they connect with your institute at Stony Brook? Are there resources online? What can people do?
Yeah, you know, we teach at universities all over the country and across the world. So if they want a workshop or if people in business want a workshop, that they can look us up on the web. It's all the communication training, or ACT, ACT, and all the Center for Communicating Science, where we teach scientists and doctors all across the country in universities. Well, and we're so busy. People want our services so much. We're scrambling to get more resources.
Well, one of your students tweeted us, Alyssa from Cincinnati tweeted, after Alan Alda's training at Stony Brook University 6 years ago, I've trained scientists in improv and communication. It works. Alan Alda, seven-time Emmy winner and the author of the new book, If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? Alan, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
Remember to send us your reviews of Wonder Woman, 855-236-1A1A. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. We're heading to Raleigh-Durham. We're finishing out the week at WUNC in North Carolina. Until we meet tomorrow, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.